My name is Marion Norris. I've been sharing some information with Neil about the National Service. My husband, David Norris, he was born on the 8th of March in 1933 in the city of Liverpool. He didn't attend a grammar school, which limited his options after school. In the 1950s, employers valued a grammar school examination. Initially, he joined friends who began to work at Leyland Motors, the factory. Leyland was expanding its operation and needed to increase its workforce. However, whilst happy to be among friends, David did not like his work. He hated it anyway, and he was determined to change his career. The communications industry appealed to him, which was state-owned and had a defined career path. He approached a manager at Preston Post Office without the possibility of becoming an engineer. About the grammar school examination issue arose and initially proved to be a barrier. However, David was a determined young man and assured the manager that he would attend night school to obtain the necessary qualification. His resolve must have impressed it, as he was taken on as a telegram boy, delivering messages to his company on his company bicycle. In the evening, he attended night school, working hard to achieve the qualifications necessary to take him on as an engineer. He succeeded and successfully applied to join the engineering branch at the post office and began training to become an engineer. Normally, in the 1950s, upon reaching 18 years of age, all UK male citizens faced conscription for military service. However, there were factors which could delay conscription. Studying for certain qualifications was one, and this indeed applied to David. Therefore, he did not receive his call-up until he'd finished his studies, at which point he was 19 years of age. He got his order to report for National Service at a local recruiting centre, arriving in the form of a letter which with the ominous words of black script emblazoned on the colour on the HMS. Upon attending the recruiter centre, it was standard practice for candidates to undergo a medical and aptitude test. David may have faced an interview from a member of the Army, Navy or RAF. The idea being the authorities could form an idea how best to employ the candidate before them. Ideally, the candidate was offered an opportunity to elect a chosen service and trade. However, this was not always the case. It seemed fortunate in David's case that his training in the post office engineering branch identified him as a perfect candidate for the Corps of Royal Signals. David was enlisted into the British Army. The official garrison stamp on David's Army record book confirms that he joined the British Army at Catterick Camp, North Yorkshire, on the 16th of October 1952. The officer recording his details in David's book records his description as 5 foot 10 in height, 145 pounds in weight, which equates to a little under 10.5 stones, with blue eyes, fair hair and a fresh complexion. It is likely he arrived by train to Richmond Station, Yorkshire. As he looked out of the window, he would have spotted a small convoy of Bedford lorries, all painted in the standard olive green colour, parked up outside the station. The drivers, awaiting the last batch of National Service recruits to transport to the infamous Catterick training camp, a non-commissioned officer would have greeted them. Resplendent in starched fatigues, he would have ordered the newcomers to jump into the back of the lorries. His short commands were the signal that National Service had begun. Catterick Camp has a long history of garrisoning and training various regiments of the British Army and was used extensively in both World Wars. It is situated about 3 miles south of the historic town of Richmond. These days, it forms the largest single establishment of the British Army, and when David arrived in 1952, it was growing. He joined the 7th Selection Regimental Royal Signals, and assigned to 7 Troop, based in a small part of the Basque camp. The troop's home was a barrack block named Baghdad, Somme, or Vimy Lines. The national servicemen who underwent the same training in the early 1950s at Vimy Lines explains how the initial few days went. He says, "We were taken in lorries to the 7th Training Regiment at Vimy Barracks for 4 weeks intensive training, drilling, shooting, field craft, map reading, but above all, learning to be totally subservient. On the first evening, we were issued with uniforms and we packed and addressed all our civilian clothes, which were taken from us to be sent to our homes. The next day, we were marched to the barber shop and told to sign for a pay advance of a shilling per man, which would be paid directly to the barber for our haircuts. We saw recruits from other groups emerging with an inch of hair on top and a quarter of an inch on the back and sides." What David experienced next is explained well in 2008 article by Keith Armitage, describing life as a National Service recruit at 7TR Catterick in 1953. The newcomer met his fellow recruits in a barrack room the size of a barn the previous evening. They were really desperate bunch of characters from all parts of the British Isles, each with their own version of the English language. He would get to know them well during the next few weeks. This barrack room, one of 6, branching off a central corridor that contained toilets, baths and wash basins, held about 30 men, and the whole wooden complex was known as the Spider. This building had soon reverberated at 6 o'clock every morning to the sound of sadistic junior NCOs banging doors open and yelling and screaming like banshees, tipping up any bed if the sleeper showed any sign of recalcitrance. All right. So this is how David's initial 4 week of basing training at Catterick would have shaped up. As he progressed, so the routine set in. Encouragingly, we know from his earlier decisions when leaving school that he enjoyed being with friends. He surely enjoyed forming new friendships and fostering the camaraderie among his troops. It had been a chastening experience being cast into a barrack room with 19 other rookies from every part of the UK and from every walk of life. It took time to get used to the various regional dialects, Geordies, Yorkie, Scouse, Scots, Welsh, etc. Although we were all new to each other, we soon realised that we were all in the same boat and a great sense of camaraderie developed among us. 2 days later, we were each given 4 injections, 2 in each arm. That evening, most of us experienced a swollen and very painful arm, apparently a normal reaction. We were soon busy on the daily task of polishing the brass buckles, etc. We had tins of brass ore and blanching our webbing. Newly issued berets, ours were navy blue. They were usually large and floppy. If there was a sure way to tell a rookie soldier from his dress, it was the presence of a cloth thing the size of a dustbin on his head. We soon discovered the best way to shrink berets was to soak them in alternate rinses of hot and cold water. Much of our basic training comprised daily sessions of marching and rifle drill. These were supplemented with weapons training, including the cleaning of our Lee Enfield rifles and dismantling and reassembling of a Bren gun. Time was spent on the firing ranges for rifle practices and a total experience of firing a Sten gun and a Bren gun. David's army training record shows that in January 1953, he fired the Bren gun and in April, the Sten gun. So his training was indeed following the established pattern of national servicemen of the time. The daily marching drill was very exhausting. Once when we were unable to effect a particular movement, our drill instructor marched us between 2 vacant barrack rooms, presumably to shield us from view. and ordered us to mark time on the spot for half an hour, which amounted to nothing less than physical torture. Discipline was quite harsh, and it was not unusual to be punished for the slightest misdemeanour. There were classes in various topics such as personal hygiene and sexually transmitted diseases, and visits by the local padre to talk of religion. We all looked forward to the mid-morning naffy break, it being a welcome relief from all our travails. One afternoon we spent pretending to be infantry, and we practiced charging across an empty field with our rifles, through a shallow river and up the other side, shouting and screaming at the top of our voices to instill fear in an imaginary enemy. The instructors were constantly looking for transgressors to perform evening and weekend fatigues. Menial chores such as spud bashing, which was peeling potatoes in the cookhouse, not by the saucepan, but a bucketful, by the galvanised steel dustbin full. Pleasingly, David clearly caught with all these trials and tribulations. He passed basic training and proceeded to the next phase of training, which was learning his trade. We have little knowledge of this phase of training, however, but it is clear that David soon became operational and left Catterick Garrison for an overseas posting. In 1953, he had the opportunity to apply for services overseas. He may have fancied a change to the climate of Northern England because he indicated a preference to serve in Korea or the Malayan Peninsula. In July 1953, the war in Korea was drawing to a close, but there were other theatres where the British Army needed personnel to face down insurgency and opposition to British rule. There was the Mau Mau insurgency in Kenya, and other situations in the Middle East were increasingly fractious. However, David found himself posted to a Southeast Asian country which was itself battling a communist-led insurgency, Malaya. Since 1948, British governance of Malaya, now Malaysia, faced challenge by the army forces of the Malayan Communist Party. The MNLA fighters were jungle-based and supported by the impoverished Chinese population. The Chinese folk lived in cities, others known as squatters, lived on the fringes of the jungle and would aid the fighters. The MNLA and its supporters called the campaign the Anti-British National Liberation War. The British, on the other hand, declined to phrase the conflict as a war. This was rather a cynical attempt to avoid paying compensation to farmers for crops destroyed in the conflict. Incidentally, hundreds of former Japanese soldiers joined the MLNA in the fight against Britain. In 1953-54, the British Army had Gurkha and regular infantry battalions in the country. However, such was the strength of the insurgency by the 1950s, the resident battalions in Malaya were strengthened with national servicemen. David remembered his sail on a troop ship from Southampton in June 1953, bound to Singapore. He even recalls the name of the ship, HMT Dilwara. He was destined to spend his national service attached to the British Army units, patrolling and guarding equipment or infrastructure in Malaya and at RAF Changi, Singapore. The national servicemen had a tough task on their hands, adapting to new surroundings. not to mention the changing climate. The heat and humidity of Malaya was vastly different to winter and spring in northern England. The newly arrived troops set up a position with residence units near villages and went out on patrols. The MLNA achieved a good deal of success and maximised the benefit of local knowledge. Meanwhile, a lack of decent intelligence and the demands of the jungle environment, which was where the vast majority of the bases were located, hampered the British Army. Consequently, although the authorities were able to prevent them, the MLN from disrupting the economy, overrunning towns or controlling territory, they were unable to stop their activities completely. And David remembers being on patrol, four of us, armed with Sten guns. We walked up this alley and suddenly they were above us. It was overlooked by buildings and they were looking down on us and throwing grenades down into the alley and shooting at us. We returned fire and we got out of there. That is what they did. They would wait and ambush you. They knew us as we were in our green uniforms, but you could not tell them from the crowd. The situation in Malaya would eventually improve with the British. With the appointment of General Sir Gerald Templer as Director of Operations and High Commissioner, a coordinated command structure was established. He placed great emphasis on the need to win the hearts and minds of the population and continued to build new settlements, promising independence once the insurgency was defeated. He also involved local populations in the fight against the MLNA, increasing the number of Malay battalions and strengthening the Home Guard raised to defend the new villages. These measures helped unite the divided Malayan population against the communists, and by October 1954, the majority of Malaya was secure. David told me about the unpleasant jobs they had to do in Malaya. During the World War II, the Japanese murdered hundreds of people, and David and his friends had to recover the bodies of these poor people and return them. The other thing he had to do was guard the trains. The communists were attacking the trains, carrying the rubber from the plantations to the ports. They went onto the trains with guns to protect them from attack. In fact, the insurgents made a point of attacking trains as well as infrastructure. They experienced considerable success derailing and damaging trains, therefore placing on guards amongst them, the rail carriages, was a necessary response. David's experience with telecommunications led him to join a bi-service team of communication specialists. His army service book documents this move. He was reclassified to 19AFSR on the 25th of March 1954. This unit was the 19 Air Formation Signals Regiment, FMN SIGS, based at RAF Changi, Singapore. He would fly with the RAF in their aeroplanes. Being a telephone engineer, they utilised him. This was whilst he was in Malaya, so he went to work in Changi. David's army book records he was awarded the General Service Medal for service to the Malayan emergency on the 16th of July, 1953. This would suggest he arrived in the country on around the 15th of June 1953. Just over 9 months later, he moved to RAF Changi, based in Singapore, and he saw out his national service there. He also remembers sailing home from Singapore to Southampton aboard HMT Empire Orwell in September 1954. After spending 18 months away from the UK, he was now entering the final month of his national service and on the October the 15th, 1954, his period of conscription ended. He recalled how he spent his national service, which he enjoyed, and in the end he loved it. He wanted to go abroad with the army and he did. He wanted to travel. He had a chance to extend his time, but couldn't make his mind up about staying in. In the end, he left it too late and left. He went back to being a telephone engineer in Preston. He sat his exams and got promoted. In fact, he ended up running the telephone exchange in Preston. He was the youngest manager in the country. However, he was getting bored with it. His experience in Malaya and Singapore had ignited a desire to travel. It wasn't long before he approached me with an idea. He came up to me and said he wanted to travel and had enough. So he went to Liverpool and spoke to a sailor, somebody on a ship. He told him he wanted to sign up as a stoker, anything. He asked David what his trade was, and when he told him he was a telephone engineer, the chap said, "Go to the Liver building and tell them what you want to be. You don't want to be down in an engine room with those skills. You can be an officer." So David went to the Liver building and spoke to the Navy. He said he wanted to be a radio officer, and they looked at his qualifications and said, "Well, you're halfway there. Go to a radio school and get the other half and you're away." So that's what he did. He came back and told me what they said, and that was that. He was very determined. He returned home to Preston with his sights firmly fixed on a career at sea. He went to his boss and told him he was resigning and going to sea. He couldn't believe it. No one at the exchange could. He'd risen through the ranks. They expected him to stay for life, but he'd made up his mind and he wanted to travel. He went to radio school for 2 years. His parents supported him, and by then we were courting. My mother helped as well. He went to night school and after a year got his qualification for radio officer second class. He was ready to return to Liverpool, but his mother said he needed to stay and do the next 12 months to get the first class, and that's what he did. He could then join as a senior officer. Once he'd obtained his radio officer's qualification, he wasted no time. He returned to Liverpool, to a Liver building in Liverpool, and was accepted into the Merchant Navy as a radio officer first class. He joined the clam line. His record book shows that he qualified as a radio officer first class on the 12th of February 1959. We were married in December 1959, and David had been away a lot in the 2 years or so before. Clanline was one of the many private shipping companies operating specific routes and sea lanes. In later developments, it would join other companies to form British and Commonwealth Shipping Limited. Having joined as a senior officer, As a senior officer, he was allowed for myself to go voyaging in nearby waters. And as we were married, we went to sea. In those days, the Merchant Navy allowed accompanied trips so far. I travelled with David in the old clan ships. I remember the first one was the Clan MacLeod, and it was a bit rough, but we had our own cabin. There was a communal bathroom, so you had to wait your turn. We spent our first 4 years of married life together at sea. We loved it. I went all over Europe, to Rotterdam and Antwerp. We spent time working the shipping routes all around Northern Britain. David was working for Clanline, so at first it was between Scotland and Ireland. It could be quite rough at times. You would see the dinner plates and cutlery passing you, but we didn't mind. It was great to be together and see all these various places. We certainly did take to life at sea. The scene was set, and David went on to enjoy a long and happy career, travelling all over the world in various ocean-going ships. As his career progressed, he moved to other shipping companies, King Line, Mediterranean Shipping Company, and they identified their messes with the MV prefix and the Union Castle Line. It was normal practice to contract Merchant Navy sailors for certain times of voyage and then move on to another contract. Kept moving to different contracts, sometimes with another line or company. Companies would also merge with various staff joining a new company. The Merchant Seaman's record book recorded progress and Davy's career at sea is well documented. One time in the English Channel, the master was not on board. The first officer wanted to show me the bridge. The master had a rule that forbade wives to even put a foot on or step up on the bridge. The master would shout at you, but this time the first officer took me up onto the bridge to see the waves down the English Channel. I went up onto the bridge. It was exhilarating and I loved it. The first officer enjoyed showing me. I wasn't able to sail on the longer ocean-going voyages, or I would have gone to South America on the Saint Rosario, I think. There was indeed an ocean-going ship called the Saint Rosario, which sailed the South American Saint Line. He went to Cape Town in South Africa and Bombay in India and Ceylon with Clam. In fact, he did most of the coast of Africa and went through the Suez Canal a few times. He travelled the world just like he wanted to. He later qualified with radar and ended up travelling to Southampton and checking the radar equipment on the ships before they left on the voyages. He was in Southampton an awful lot.